Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased to have with us Professor Heather Jones. Professor Jones is Professor of Modern Contemporary History at University College London. She is an expert on the Great War and has written extensively on the subject. And today we are discussing her new book, For King and Country, British Monarchy and the First World War, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Professor Jones.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Charles.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
The main argument of my book is that the role of the British monarchy in the First World War has been really overlooked, not just in terms of its role behind the scenes, in terms of influencing political decision making, but also its role as a cultural symbol and its importance in mobilizing an idea of Britishness in support of the war effort.
Why do you not entirely agree with the modernization thesis as per the British monarchy in the beginning of the 20th century?
So a lot of historians who've worked on the monarchy have made the argument that at the start of the 20th century, the monarchy modernized very successfully. It used mass media in new ways. It became a kind of accessible democratic institution. And what I felt looking at the war was that actually the situation is a bit more mixed. These ideas about modernization actually are happening in a context where very, very old and, if you like, somewhat archaic ideas about monarchy are also part of the picture and part of the mix. People see the monarchy as sacred. There's a lot of religious ideas around the monarchy as well. And these older ideas about a kind of sacred kingship role in British society and the idea of a kind of continual royal lineage linking Britishness back through time are very much present as well. So the modernization that's taking place, the mass media images of the monarchy, are actually about transferring messages that are actually quite archaic and quite old about monarchy.
Why, prior to your book, was the period of the Great War an unexplored topic as per the British monarchy?
That's a very good question. I think one of the reasons is that actually historians of monarchy have tended to stop in 1914. They haven't really addressed the monarchy after that period in such detail. Partly that's to do with source access and the fact that the monarchy itself remained obviously very politically relevant in Britain and a sensitive issue. But partly it's also because specialists in monarchy did tend to focus on the 19th century and specialists on war tended not to really be specialists on monarchy. So we had a kind of fragmentation of the historical profession as well. And to bring those two historiographies of monarchy and of the First World War together, which my book does really for the first time, was something very important, I felt. I felt that the wartime monarchy, in a way, had fallen between two stools, and as a result, it's sort of been forgotten and certainly had been overlooked.
Do you agree with the Arno Mayer thesis of the continuity of the Ancien Régime up to 1914, as you appear to do so in your book?
I think many aspects of the Ancien Régime survived through the First World War. So I would say a tentative or qualified yes, I would agree with that point in your question.
And what does one mean exactly by the phrase, the term, the long First World War?
So recent scholars such as Robert Gervarth and John Horne have argued that when we look at World War I and we look at it just as a conflict from 1914 to 1918, what we're effectively doing is simply taking a kind of Western Front dateline. And in fact, if we look at this as a war of empires, global empires, and the fallout of the violence from the First World War, it has a much later end date, pushing it right through to 1923. The Great War for the Ottoman Empire and its successor state, the New Republic of Turkey, really doesn't end till 1923. And likewise for Greece, if you look at the Greco-Turkish War that follows on directly from the First World War and really is, in many ways, a continuity conflict. And if we look at the start of the First World War, again, the picture starts to look a lot more mixed if we start thinking about the war as something that comes from the falling apart of empires and tensions around empires in Europe in this period. And so the start date of the war for Gervarth and Horne is 1911 and the Ottoman Empire's weakening and the Italian invasion of what was then Ottoman Libya. So those kinds of wars before the war start to look much more like part of the First World War. If we start to look at what it might have been like to be someone living in the Balkans in this period, you're effectively at war from the First Balkan War of 1912 right through to 1923. So the idea that there's just one set of dates for World War I and those happen to be the dates of the Western European powers, it doesn't really fit in terms of when we start looking at this as a global war and a global conflict.
Why do you believe that the popular image of King George V as a stamp collector and as a hunter a mistaken one?
I think the popular image comes from a 1950s biography of the king that was done by the writer Harold Nicholson. And Harold Nicholson really emphasized some of the king's personal habits. So his stamp collecting, his obsession with hunting. But these were actually his pastimes. In a way, they were his stress relief, if you like. His actual role as monarch is a very difficult one in this whole period of his reign, but particularly in World War I. And Nicholson's book really downplayed the war, and it really didn't give any attention to the emotional stress that leading figures had during the war. So, for example, the king is visiting hospitals sometimes three times a day, seeing wounded men, disfigured men. Men who are dying from their wounds. The Queen also is visiting these hospitals. They spend a lot of time visiting the war wounded right from the start of the war, right through the whole 4 years of the conflict. This is incredibly stressful and draining and difficult. And there's also a huge responsibility on the monarch, because this is a war for king and country. And one of the things my book really argues is we've forgotten that in 1914, during the period where Britain was mobilizing around a voluntary army and didn't have conscription, one of the incentives that's used to get men to join up is this idea that they're fighting for their king. And the monarchy is very romanticized in that early war propaganda. It's very much seen as a reason for fighting, doing your duty to the king, serving your monarch. All this language is very much there in those first years of the war. And so the king felt a huge responsibility for the whole of his life from the moment this war broke out onwards, that these men had died for him. And so this isn't, when you start looking at the emotional life and stresses that George V endured during the war, and suddenly you start to see what the stamp collecting is about, and you start to see it in perspective. So, for example, when he returns from seeing some of these horrific war wounded injuries, he goes and looks at his stamp collection. So it's a way of trying to switch off. Nicholson very unfairly sort of seems to think that that's all the king was effectively doing in many ways, that was his entire inner life. But actually, I think us today, we would understand that as something where someone is responding to and trying to deal with the emotional stresses of their day job by having something that's very escapist and allows them to leave that behind. Another key thing about what the monarch is doing is he's putting himself in danger during the war quite deliberately. He's not able to go and lead his men on the battlefield, but he is able to visit them on the battlefield, and quite deliberately frames his visits to the Western Front. He makes six. He tries to frame these as being with his men when they go to fight. And on one occasion at the start of the Battle of Amiens, he's actually there at the start of the battle watching it from higher ground. So there's very much a sense of him trying to be present. He tries to go into the places that have just been recently bombarded. In some cases, he's actually in villages that have just been shelled or are shelled after he leaves. He's never in the exact front line because he's actually constitutionally prohibited from leading his troops into battle, but he is very much putting himself in danger, and that's also very stressful. So this idea of kind of hunting and stamp collecting as some kind of, you know, king who's not paying attention to the war, or who's just spending it in kind of luxury away from the front, it couldn't be more incorrect. This is someone who works incredibly hard and puts himself in danger.
Why do you claim that the UK monarchy was, quote, the key diplomatic channel, unquote, in the July crisis of 1914, when most of the recent literature would query this?
Well, actually, there's not very much recent literature on what the monarchy is doing in July 1914. Most of the literature really overlooks the role of Buckingham Palace and what's going on there, and focuses very much on the Foreign Office. And so these back channels and the role of the monarchy and the way that it's used to try and actually stop the war by the British government isn't really very much examined. If you look at Thomas Otte's recent book, there's not really any mention in there about what the monarchy's doing in the July crisis. And so I think this is a whole area that really needs to be revisited, actually. And there's probably room for more work. My own book touches on it, but I think there's certainly a lot more room to go and look at the archives across Europe and see how they actually respond to these messages coming through Buckingham Palace to them about the build up to war. But what's clear is that the aura of the monarchy is being used by the British government and the Foreign Office, and actually there are two sites by which Britain is communicating with European powers during the July crisis. It's communicating through the Foreign Office and also through the King and through Buckingham Palace. And when it wants to really make a statement to the Tsar or the Kaiser, it speaks through the King, because this is an era where most European states are controlled and governed directly by monarchs. Britain's unusual in its constitutional monarchy format, and that the monarchy is quite constrained in the political realm. But in terms of the Kaiser, the Tsar, they will speak to a fellow monarch much more openly, and they will respect a fellow monarch more than politicians from other states, civilian politicians from other states. So the monarchy is very, very important in giving gravitas to those messages of the British government to these absolute monarchs across Europe and constitutional monarchs across Europe. And this is something that I think has been actually very much overlooked in the existing historiography. Again, the existing historiography until the cultural turn of the 1990s really focused very much on kind of traditional understandings of power. We would think more now in terms of soft power and the role and the importance of Britain using the monarchy in that way in its international relations in 1914.
So you don't believe that the fact that people like Otte or Christopher Clark or Sean McMeekin don't make reference to the monarchy, British or otherwise, as being prime movers in the crisis, more a case that there's little evidence for it, so then hence the narrative omits it?
No, I wouldn't. I think there's a lot of questions about access to sources still in terms of the Royal Archives. I think in terms of the way in which politicians liaise with the King, if you think of that late night dash by Asquith to Buckingham Palace, where the King is got out of bed and asked to approve and actually chip in to drafting a telegram to the Tsar. I mean, there's much that actually there we really need to revisit. I would argue that it isn't the case that the monarchy matters more than the civilian politicians, but it's that they're working hand in hand on this, and they're all trying to avoid war. And to neglect one aspect of that dynamic, which in 1914 is a very different dynamic to the role of the monarchy in the post-war period, where it operates differently. It still has a lot of political direct input in a Europe of monarchies in 1914. To ignore that, I think, is mistaken. I mean, those are wonderful historians you've named, but yes, I would say that the monarchy needs to be looked at more for that July crisis moment.
Actually, your response leads directly to my next question, which is exactly or approximately how much hard and soft power did George V have during the period of the Great War?
That's a very good question, because it actually fluctuates. So in terms of his areas of power, one of his most important areas is consulting. So if you think about the role of the monarchy to warn, to consult, to advise, what he does is he basically consults and advises the government on military matters, both in terms of military appointments, where he's very important, and particularly in keeping Haig in his position towards the end of the war, when many of the civilian politicians want Haig gone. the monarchy's backing for Haig is really fundamental in Haig retaining that role. He's also very important in terms of some of the government formation in wartime as well. He has a direct role when asked with falls from power. He's a direct role at that point politically. He's a direct role in the plans for conscription. Politicians are going to Buckingham Palace. There are meetings behind closed doors about what form conscription will take. Will it happen? Can it happen? Remember, these are the king's armies that are being discussed. And so therefore, the king is as commander in chief of the army, which is the power that's delegated then to the actual commander in chief in the field. The king is commander in chief constitutionally of the British Army, has a huge role there. So that is really, I think, in many ways where his most important power lies. There's also the question of Privy Council legislation. So during the war, a lot of legislation is passed by Privy Council because it is simply not possible to get it through Parliament in wartime fast enough. So there's a question there as well about what exactly is the role of the monarchy in terms of legislative processes in wartime too. But I think in terms of the hard power, it's in that area of the army, military patronage, advising and consulting on military strategy. Yes, the king doesn't always get his way, but what a key role he has in terms of influencing and in terms of advising and in terms of, in some cases, directly intervening and saying he doesn't want something to go ahead. He's, if you like, one of the government's key advisors in wartime. He doesn't have direct control, but his input is very weighty and is often taken into account in cabinet meetings.
Why do you not agree with the thesis that monarchical power declined during the Lloyd George premiership?
I think that thesis is overplayed. I think Lloyd George would have liked it to have declined. I think that's one of his aims. He wants to reform the monarchy. He's not actually an anti-monarchist as such. He's in a more complex position on the monarchy. But he is an outsider who has come into this system and who doesn't like aspects of it, and particularly, I think, feels very class conscious of his own more humble origins in this system. So he would like it to decline. I think the monarchy also fear that that is what he is about, and they fear the extent to which he will push those reforms. They fear, in some cases, that some of the more right-wing advisers around the court actually fear Lloyd George may be on the road to dictatorship. Now, we know now with hindsight that that is incorrect, but it's what people think at the time in history that often is as important in understanding their decision-making as what actually unfolds. So the things they get wrong influence how they make up their minds, and they get Lloyd George wrong at the palace. He is a Democrat. He is actually in favour of Britain's existing constitutional system with a monarchy. But he is gung-ho on trying to pull back some of the power, particularly around the military, that the king has. But he's not able to conclusively do this. And particularly in the symbolic reign, the king really retains a huge amount of power and popularity that Lloyd George simply doesn't have at some of the more difficult points in the war. So if one thinks of the mass strikes in the north of England by munitions workers in 1917 and in parts of Scotland, the Red Clyde, when they occur, the government discuss the cabinet what to do, and they actually decide to send the king and queen to those areas on what at the time is termed kind of royal tours, where they visit the munitions factories and where the king actually talks to militant workers. And they do this because they know that Lloyd George can't go there. Lloyd George is not popular, particularly in radical Scotland. And so it is actually the monarchy that is more popular, the king that is more popular, who carries still that sacred aura, that sacralized image and that kind of gravitas of as a British historical figure as part of that monarchical genealogy. And he can go there, and he is able with that kind of personal touch to calm those situations. So I think, you know, Lloyd George spins his own myth after the war, and particularly his memoirs, where he plays things up that he wants to play up. And he, you know, he really would have liked to maybe reform the monarchy even more. He only gets some quite limited reforms around the question of honours. And even then, that comes back to bite him in the post-war era. But when he actually gets then gets accused of giving a kind of cash for honours scandal, because he'd kind of corrupted the honour system by trying to offer honours in exchange for favours. So I think I personally would challenge the argument that had existed in some of the older historiography that, you know, this period of Lloyd George's premiership was a period of radical removal of power from the monarchy. When you actually look at it in detail, that isn't what's happening.
Why do you believe that, quote, the monarchy helped shape the pattern of British voluntary mobilization, unquote, in the first 2 years of the Great War?
I think it's very important that we look at how the idea of a monarchist state is part of the rhetoric and the romance that is built into this word volunteering campaign, this recruitment campaign in those years before conscription. So if we look at the rhetoric that's used, everything from music hall songs right through to posters and images and the slogan for King and Country, or Your King and Country Want You, monarchy is central to this. There has to be some kind of, if you like, brand Britain, if you want to put it that way, for people to kind of latch onto as they go off to fight. And when you start to delve into what is Britishness in 1914, this archipelago of islands that make up the United Kingdom in this period and this global empire, what is it all about? Well, ultimately, fundamentally, it comes down to a dynastic loyalty to the King Emperor George V. And that is really used in war recruitment propaganda in the first 2 years of the war. And so those are the reasons why I would say that monarchism and channeled through the figure of the king, but also the wider royal family, the queen and particularly their two older sons. Monarchism is really key to how Britain understands itself and what it thinks it's fighting for in those first 2 years of the war.
How did the prevailing honor culture adapt and change, if at all, during the Great War?
So honor culture is an argument I made that in 1914, to understand how British society operates, we need to understand the ways people understood reputation and respectability and all of those things. And in fact, it was a culture based on the ideas of honour, of doing your duty, and particular ideas that there are gendered forms of honour, men's honour, women's honour, that depend on someone's personal good name and their reputation. And doing your duty to your king was part of being an honourable man in this society at this time. And this idea of an honour culture during the war, it's something that we see right through the war, but it does really evolve. And it's much less visible in the 1917-1918 period, where we are seeing war weariness. We are seeing at the front, we are seeing some soldiers very much, becoming disenchanted with the idea of the monarchy or monarchism or a war for monarchy. Very influenced also, there's elements of the Russian Revolution spilling over into some of this as well. But honor culture really revives and finds a new role around honoring the war dead. And so although there are these moments of tension in the war around the idea of kind of a monarchy and a kind of honoring the king, once the war ends, honoring the war dead becomes a raison d'etre for the British monarchy. And they're able to channel war commemoration in ways that then give them a role for the interwar world. And that's something that that becomes very valuable to them in a period where the rest of Europe is effectively in revolution and abandoning the idea of monarchical states.
Why do you say that, quote, the monarchy was at the center of how the war was represented to populations across the empire, unquote?
Well, because I think the monarchy was central to how the war was represented to populations around the empire. If we look at war posters, war songs, war propaganda, war photographs, official photographs from the Western Front, war regalia, and there's monarchist symbols on in many of the regimental heraldry. There's monarchist symbols in terms of the discussion of the king's armies. Monarchist language is very much present. So I think it's very difficult once you start actually, thinking about monarchism as a cultural form. It's very difficult to actually avoid it in the types of propaganda being produced. And now there are flashpoints around this. So if we look at South Africa, for example, where really South Africa is a very recent incorporation to the British Empire at this point, because of the Second South African War, better known maybe as the Boer War, it's an area where there are a lot of people who have just literally become British subjects who previously had been fighting Britain, and for some of them, monarchism and the British monarchy is a really big problem, and they are much more republican in their view. Likewise, if we look at Ireland, part of the United Kingdom in this period, a lot of anti-monarchism there, a lot of rebellious attitudes towards monarchy. And so actually sometimes we actually find the extent of the monarchism being sent out to parts of the British Isles and the Empire. We find it in those rebellious moments as well, where people actually are alienated by that or antagonized by that. But certainly the monarchy is fundamental to how Britain is representing itself across its empire.
Why did the February Revolution in Russia trigger an upsurge in anti-monarchical discourse in the United Kingdom?
So the February Revolution is a really interesting moment because a lot of observers hoped that would lead to a liberal democratic Russia. They didn't expect it to result in a Bolshevik revolution, which happens towards the end of the year. So there's a lot of people who are actually, a lot of liberals in Western Europe are actually quite positive about that February Revolution moment. And one of the things that we find in the British case, in the British home front, is that at the moment of the February Revolution, it unleashes a mass panic at court. It really alarms the advisors of George V. They fear this is going to happen in Britain as well. They become actually over alarmed about this because the Tsar has been, he's a cousin, he's a close relation of George V. George V is very, very fond of him. They actually have a very close friendship as well as being cousins. And so that sense of alarm starts to spread. And then there's also the February Revolution also allows for the first time discussion about monarchy as a system of governance. And this has really been missing for most of the first years of the war. You look in vain for any discussion earlier in the war about the monarchy's German origins in Britain. You look for discussion about any kind of discussion about a republican system, any kind of discussion about whether the language of for king and country is inappropriate at this point in the modern 20th century. And you don't find it. There is no debate around these issues, either in private sources or in public sources in Britain. But after the February Revolution, you start to see radical fringe movements, particularly groups associated around the very radical fringes of the London socialist press, starting to actually speak out about monarchies in Europe in general and saying that they're glad the Tsar has fallen, and then to raise the question as to whether monarchy itself is actually too old fashioned as a system of government. And they're not that many direct attacks on George V, actually, as a person, even when people are being critical in those radical fringe press or organs, when they're discussing monarchy, they're very careful to avoid attacking King George V and Queen Mary, because they're still very popular as individuals. So what I found when I looked into this in quite a lot of detail is the February Revolution allows a space to talk about monarchy as a system and whether that is the best system for governance. And it's usually framed in terms of discussing what's happening in Russia or what should happen in Germany, where the Tsar is presented as a tyrant monarch, and often framed in a way where that's discussed. And then the writer will conclude with, but of course, in Britain, our king is wonderful and we have a constitutional system. And don't we show how much better that is than those continental tyrannical monarchies? So actually, even some of the criticism ends up being, backhanded compliment to the actual British king and queen. And the areas where there is actual real criticism and arguments for a British republic are very, are very limited. There's a letter to the press by H.G. Wells, which provokes a massive pro-monarchist backlash. And there's some discussion in some of the very radical socialist newspapers. In some cases, those are newspapers that are quite closely associated with continental radical revolutionary groups. And that, there we see some strong anti-monarchism, but they are not. They are not press sources with large circulation. So the palace finds those, they're picked up by police intelligence, but it really, I think, overreacts because it thinks this is possibly going to spread mainstream. Now, one of the things that's really interesting in this is that what some of those radical groups pick up on is George V's German ancestry. And so this is the first time, April 1917 is the first time you start to see any discussion of the fact the royals have some German ancestry, which is, I mean, they have a huge amount. Queen Mary is originally of Teck, right? So, I mean, her parents were German. So there's quite a lot of kind of opening here to a discussion about the king being German, and that makes the monarchy panic and think that they have to cut this off. They have to act before any major press debate unfolds about the king's Germanness. And so they change the name to Windsor at that point in a preemptive move before there is a kind of massive anti-German surge against the monarchy. So in a way, by doing that, the anti-German surge peters out, and we don't get a huge movement accusing the British monarch of being German in the way that you do in Russia, for example, against the Tsarina. And it's notable the difference in the two countries. You just don't get that in the British case. So the shift to the name of Windsor is a preemptive move. It's a very shrewd move. It's very clever. And the advisor, Lord Stamford, who's the king's kind of right-hand man through the war, his private secretary, is absolutely instrumental to that move. So that February Revolution moment is a turning point. But we mustn't overplay it. There isn't I argue in the book, and you know, I think it's a really important point to make. There isn't a real threat to the safety of the British monarchy in 1917 and 1918 in Britain itself. There simply isn't evidence of that on any large scale. These are very, very minor voices that are making these arguments about the radical arguments about the King's Germanness in April 1917.
So in fact, you don't actually use the term, but in fact, the overreaction by the court, from your perspective, did that result in so little anti-monarchical action in the UK? We leaving out, of course, Catholic Ireland.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I think their overreaction in February actually ultimately sort of saves them, because they jump in before things get out of hand. They jump in before this moves from being a kind of a discussion in fringe newspapers, in some certain quarters of London, of the kind of London radical press. And this isn't even mainstream Labour. OK, this is right on the fringes. These are organs of socialist fringe movements that haven't actually got very much of a following. And so that overreaction actually protects them by the time we get to the end of the year, when the Bolshevik Revolution happens, and it protects them into 1918, when war weariness is really spreading. And if one thinks about, you know, spring 1918 is when Britain nearly loses the war. It comes very, very close to that. And at the point where its armies are under huge pressure, being pushed back in the spring Ludendorff offensives, the king rushes to the front. He rushes to the front within days of the offensive starting, to be with his troops. Had Britain been defeated at that point, the monarchy would have been associated with defeat in the field. So I think that change of the name to Windsor and the popularity of that in 1917, it's a fill-up that actually ends up protecting the monarchy going through into 1918 as well.
Would this history be very different if either Edward VII or Edward VIII were king during this period?
I think it would have been very different. I think Edward VII, in terms of his imagery in wartime, it would have been a bad fit. He was fond of the good life. He liked partying, liked women. It's questionable whether he would have been able to switch into war leader mode in the way that George V does. George V presents a very austere wartime image. Food in the palaces is rationed. Before rationing is actually brought in nationally, they're always ahead of the curve in terms of trying to anticipate what public expectations will be, what war sacrifice will look like in 6 months' time, for example. So they cut back on all entertainments. In fact, they stop having any large dinners at any of the palaces. They cut back on entertaining. The king dresses solely in uniform, basically, for most of the war. He gives up alcohol, famously, but they also give up an awful lot of other things. So no theatre, no going to the horse racing, nothing really except the hunting on his private estate at Sandringham. That's the only thing that continues. And then he gives all the birdsey bags to various war charities and war causes. And the queen is so draconian on the food situation that there's no pastries, that they're eating meat only I think 3 days a week. It's all completely draconian, their austerity measures that are brought in. And I just don't think Edward VII would have been as quick to do that and to shift his image to that. George V is a new king when the war breaks out. He's only been on the throne a couple of years, so he's able to form his image very quickly as a war leader. People don't have preconceptions about him. And he's much less associated with the international sphere too. As a result, it was his father who was associated with that Europe of very dramatic and splendid living monarchies. So I think that works to George V's favor, and I think Edward VII would have struggled. In terms of Edward VIII, as we know, in the Second World War, after his abdication, he is a war liability. Post-abdication, he is basically liaising with Germany. At one point, he is passing on information through the German embassy in Madrid, suggesting that the way to win the war against Britain is to bomb it, to bomb his own people. So Edward VIII, had he been king in the First World War, one can only speculate, but it's quite likely he would have sought in some way to get some kind of more comfortable life reasonably quickly. I mean, even as Prince of Wales, he's on the Western Front, he's enduring the war. he makes a lot of efforts at the start to try and sacrifice on a par with the soldiers he's serving alongside with. But, you know, towards the end of the war, his ability to sustain that really peters out. He's not someone with stamina. And so you see him starting to actually want to party, going to Paris, letting off steam, you know, visiting prostitutes, having a kept courtesan is one, you know, his favorite prostitute. So he starts to actually kind of try and live the good life in wartime as well. And it doesn't get out during the First World War. The press situation means it doesn't get out. But you can see the problems had it ever reached the public sphere. So George V, sandwiched between those two other figures, he was a much better fit for the type of war that World War I was and for the type of image that needed to be projected of a monarch who understood that he needed to suffer and sacrifice with his people and sustain that for 4 years, not just for the first couple of years like his son did as Prince of Wales, but the whole way through.
Can you expand on your statement, quote, "The view that the First World War seriously undermined the British monarchy is largely inaccurate," unquote?
Yes, I think I would absolutely expand on that. I think the monarchy emerges from the war in the long term strengthened. I think what you see is the monarchy is compared favourably to other European monarchies, very skillfully by pro-monarchists in both the British establishment and in other parts of British society at the time, particularly the Church of England. And so one sees there's a kind of argument made that actually the British monarchy is different, unique, special, specifically British, not European, not like those other monarchies on the continent that are all falling in 1918, 1919, but something that is very particular to Britain. And as a result, is an element, a core element of national pride and national identity and national association. So that, you know, that I think is actually really key here. You get an idea of British uniqueness and the British monarchy as unique coming out of the war. And that stands to its kind of sustains it going through the 20th century because it can always fall back on this uniqueness argument ever after. Likewise, I think the monarchy really is strengthened by its association with the war dead. And this is really strange because one would expect anger from the war bereaved. One would expect them to be really to feel resentment that their sons had died and sons and husbands had died for king and country, and that the king part of that would be blamed. But this isn't what happens. And actually, the king is the chief mourner at the burial of the unknown warrior in Westminster Abbey. And that is seen as something that is seen as honouring the war dead. It's seen as a very beautiful moment, a very cathartic moment for many of the war bereaved. And the idea that the unknown warrior is buried, as it says on his tombstone, among the kings. The suggestion is that he's elevated, that the unknown warrior is elevated to the status of a royal family member and honoured by the royal family. And obviously that then puts the royal family in the same sacred aura as the war dead themselves. So they actually gain from this kind of symbiotic relationship that is established during the war between monarchy and war dead. And there's such a colossal mass death during the war that for British society, you know, after the war, putting up all these memorials, many, many of which choose to use the phrase that men from this parish who died for their king and country, men from this railway company who died for their king and country. Seeing that everywhere actually reinforces monarchy into the interwar years.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
One of the key things I would like people to take away from my book is that the role of the monarchy needs to be revisited for the First World War period. That there's a lot of really important changes that are happening there that actually set up legacies for the rest of the 20th century around what monarchy means to British society and how it understands it. And the other key thing I'd really like people to take from my book is that you can't make arguments about the dangers of republicanism to the British monarchy in the First World War without discussing Ireland. And the historiography before on the monarchy that exists for this period has almost entirely focused on the island of Britain and left out Ireland, which was part of the United Kingdom at the time. And one of the things as an Irish writer living in England that I realised almost immediately when I started working on this topic was a real Republican threat looks like what happened in the south of Ireland in 1919 to 21. When you see, you know, monarchist statues pulled down, you see people crossing out the image of the king on stamps, you see protests in cinemas when they show newsreel of the king, You see flags torn down. You see none of this in 1917, 1918 Britain. You see, in 1917, 1918 Britain, the Prince of Wales can travel to Parliament without a security escort. This is not a monarchy in danger. This is not a monarchy that's at risk in the way that the monarchy in Russia is or the monarchy in Germany is by the end of the war. This is a monarchy that's actually very secure, but that is terrified within itself because of its fears of what the war might unleash. Quite sensibly afraid of this huge, terrible total war and the kinds of dynamics it might unleash. But this is not, we don't actually see those fears materializing. Britain's monarchist culture proves robust enough to actually come through the war. And ultimately, I argue, the war ends up in some ways really strengthening it.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Jones, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Jones.
Thank you very much, Charles. It was a pleasure.